A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the podcast from the New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
This week, we're going to be talking about the film Lion and the BBC Three dramedy Witless.
Caroline has also read some stories from Daisy Johnson's collection Fen for the first time, so she'll be telling us how that went later in the show. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously.
We've been checking out our iTunes page and it is such a happy place at the moment. Thank you so much to everyone who responded to our call for reviews last week. It's really heartening to see the show like getting some love on there.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thanks also to everyone who responded to our Twitter poll. If you're not following us on Twitter, it is SRSLYpod. Thank you so much for voting for the theme of our next event. Overwhelmingly, you went with Harry Potter again.
Yeah,
I mean, third time in a row.
Thank you to everyone who clicked on the OC, but sadly, Harry Potter triumphed again. So our next quiz is going to be on the 14th of March at the same venue again, the Book Club in Shoreditch in London. Tickets are going to go on sale on the 15th of February at midday.
Yep, so you've got plenty of time to organise yourself into teams, get ready to buy tickets, etc. Be great to see you there.
We've also been looking through your emails this week. We had this really nice one from Lucy, who said, I just thought I'd write in to recommend the Channel 4 dark comedy series Flowers, on the off chance that one or both of you haven't seen it. It centres around the Flowers family, headed by depressed children's author Mr. Flowers, played by Julian Barrett, and his resentful wife Mrs. Flowers, played by Olivia Colman, as well as deluded inventor son Donald and his lesbian Kate Bush-esque twin sister Amy, as they grapple with personal and familial demons.
I remember seeing that this was on, and everyone seemed to be talking about it, and I just kind of missed the zeitgeist.
Ditto. She says, while initially cringeworthy and surreal, I don't think I've ever seen the difficulties of depression in family life portrayed so honestly and heartbreakingly on TV before. So,
well, this has got all our favourite people in Flowers, hasn't it?
It does indeed.
So we definitely do need to check it out.
Yeah, so thanks for the nudge, Lucy.
I never know whether I think listeners would like to hear the email noise where I'm like, here's another email. I've got it in my hand.
We do actually print them out because we're that lo-fi.
I always try and hide it, but this is the next email. This is from Catherine, who says she wanted to write and thank you for reviewing The Worst Witch. I imagine it must be difficult to decide what you're going to watch and read each week, and some things might be a gamble. And I think The Worst Witch is probably one of our more gambly choices.
Yeah, that's true. It's on CBBC and it is a remake of a much beloved adaptation. So
she says she has vague but happy memories of the books and the previous TV series, but stumbled on it again when watching with her 4-year-old daughter, Isla. And she says they've been watching happily together and it was great to hear your thoughts on it. After all, don't 4-year-olds deserve to take pop culture seriously too?
Yes, they do.
Yes.
Excellent sloganizing.
She also thinks that kids' TV is definitely better than they used to be in her day when it was Biker Grove and the Flintstones and Why Don't You? So thanks for giving this one a shot. Well, I love The Worst Witch, so it was an easy choice for me. But thank you, Catherine, for getting in touch.
And actually, we had a couple of really good tweets about this from @SarahDytum, who said that she was just catching up on the episode, love the chat on Worst Witch, but feel compelled to point out that CBBC has strong drama chops with Wolfblood, Millie, In Between, and Dumping Ground, all big faves of my daughter, who is a TV expert.
Oh, very good. Well, I'm glad, because we did say, didn't we thought it was better than CBBC content generally is, and then we were like, hang on, we don't watch it, we don't know that.
Yeah, well, we're not in a position to judge, so very, very happy to be corrected on that.
Yeah.
I'm glad that that level of quality is, you know, there's depth and breadth in the output. So first this week, we're going to be talking about the film Lion, which is based on the true story of Saru Brierley, as told in his memoir A Long Way Home. And he's played in this film adaptation by Dev Patel. Saru was born and grew up in India, but after losing his brother at a railway station one night, ends up on a long-distance train to Calcutta. After being placed in an orphanage, he's eventually adopted by an Australian couple, played by Nicole Kidman and David Wenman. As an adult, Saru manages to retrace his journey using Google Earth and find his way back to his original village.
Gudu? Gudu?
Back home.
How long are you on the train?
A couple of days.
A couple of days.
It would take a lifetime to search all the stations in India.
Do you have any idea what it's like? How every day my real brother screams my name?
I always thought that I could keep this family together.
I need you, Saru.
What if you do find home and they're not even there? And you just keep searching?
Yeah, so it's a completely remarkable true story.
Yeah, and I remember actually the news stories about this when it first happened, because he actually did the retracing in 2012, I think, and then the book came out in 2014. But I remember, like, BBC News, like, wrote it up. He was on the World Service and everything. It was a international news story. I guess the confluence of, like, ultimately heartwarming personal story plus technology in 2012 was a really big deal.
Because the role of Google Earth is obviously massive in how he manages to figure out where he's from, because Saru is so young when he goes missing. He doesn't really know the name of the place where he lives. He only refers to his mum as mum. He has no idea how far away from home he is, or like what the larger district is that his village is in. So he has no real way of anchoring himself.
There's also the language barrier.
Yeah, it's massive.
Which is massive.
I didn't even think of that. Well, obviously, there are so many languages in India.
So I think it's the case that he grew up speaking Hindi, mm-hmm. and then he ended up in Calcutta, where the majority of people speak Bengali, I think is right. So he just couldn't talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm. It's such a detailed and sort of complicated homecoming story that this film is devoted to that one part of Saru's life, right? It's really from start to finish that story in its full detail without ever going into much other stuff about his life.
Yeah, so there are a few like side plots touched on, but they do all also intersect with that main narrative. Mm. So Rooney Mara plays his kind of love interest. They have a like slightly turbulent relationship, and you know, he has various outbursts where he's like, you just don't understand what this is like for me to go through, etc., mm-hmm. etc. I was not actually a massive fan of that interaction, because I felt like she didn't really get much of a character. She wasn't really fleshed out. She was mostly just there for Saru to like shout at.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of felt that about all the characters in this. I think, and again, it comes back to the strength of that true story. So I don't particularly blame the filmmakers for making this decision, but it feels like every single other character and every single other plot point is just used to further this one A plot, which is obviously happens in a lot of films, but there was something more striking about it happening to me. There was a moment where Dev Patel was sort of dancing on the street, and I was like, this is the only insight we get into his character outside of this story. And even then, it's like for 5 seconds, and it's just Dev Patel playing like a normal, fun kind of guy. We don't know what his interests are. We know there's at one point they mention that he used to be into athletics, but they only sort of say that so that they can be like, but now he's always on the couch because he's so obsessed with finding out who his parents are. So I feel like even the main character has that same problem where he doesn't get a full character. He's just a person looking for his family, and that's the one thing you know about him.
Yeah, and that is both good and bad in the film, because it does have this like tremendous sense of like emotional momentum. I found watching it, you know, there's lots of shots of the young Saru like in the long distance train that he's kind of trapped in. You know, he doesn't know where to get off, or even if he can get off, and he's on it for days before he gets to Calcutta, and you do feel a bit like you're kind of being dragged through the story in that same way, like you couldn't get off and enjoy a side plot even if you wanted to. You know, that it's like this great big narrative force.
That's a good way of putting it. And I did find those scenes really unbearable of this young kid completely lost and alone and with no idea of how to get off this train, no idea of how to speak to anyone. The fear and the confusion comes across so strongly. Yeah, I wanted to get off that train. but you can't. You're sort of forced to watch it. And I found myself willing for him to grow up because I was sort of like, I can deal with this story of like a late 20s year old man going through these traumas, but I can't cope with it when it's this young kid who's got no one. So yeah, I was really like, please, where's Dev Patel? Hurry up. I can't bear it.
Yeah, the child actor who plays like young Saru is really good.
I know, and he looks so much like the real man, whereas Dev Patel just doesn't at all.
He doesn't at all, and actually I felt like this film was slightly let down by its poster, actually, because on the poster it's got like big Dev Patel face at the top, and then like small Saru underneath, and it's obviously like boy grows into man, man grows on quest is what you're supposed to get from the poster. But they don't look like each other.
No.
And also Dev Patel's doing a very like noble suffering face, which just makes me laugh a little bit.
Yeah, and I think Dev Patel just looks so much like someone you'd meet in the pub in Bristol. And I don't know, there's something that I find less grand about that person. And obviously it's good that Dev Patel has such like a human portrait of this guy. That's a great thing. But there's something about his style of acting that makes it hard for me to think of him as like grandiose Oscar performer. Yeah. He's so like, because he's like from Skins and everything about him seems so familiar to me in a way.
I feel like the Academy has slightly recognised this by giving him a nomination for Best Supporting Actor in a film that he is clearly the star of.
I guess it is weird, isn't it? But his story doesn't kick in until sort of halfway through the runtime. So I guess he's supporting in that sense, but he's certainly not supporting in terms of him supporting any other performers, because it's always about him whenever he's on screen.
Who is the lead actor if it's not him?
Exactly.
So yeah, that I think is a bit odd, but I think perhaps, indicative of the way the film is structured.
So yeah, I mean, it's just another biopic, and it just seems like the Academy and the film industry in general is just not going to get bored of like noble, quite serious biopics, right? We've got Jackie, there's this Gold movie coming out with Matthew McConaughey that's another based on true events story, and you know, last year it was Spotlight and Room doesn't really count, does it? Spotlight and all these movies, just it just feels constant to me. And sometimes I'll be watching a movie and I'll be like, you wouldn't make this movie if it wasn't based on true events.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I felt a little bit like that with Lion, like, would you make this story if it wasn't so that you could go, and wow, look at this real footage we have at the end, and wow, can't you believe that he actually achieved this incredible, difficult feat? And I'm not sure you would make Lion as a movie if you didn't have the real guy to point to.
No, I don't think you would. I mean, I've not read the memoir that it's based on, but apparently it was really good. So I think I might actually seek that out now, because I am interested in the real story, as told factually by the person it happened to. But yeah, as a fictional portrayal, you're right, I don't know whether anyone would commission that.
So slightly odd, but I would love to see the young Saru actor in more things, because he was just like, at no point were you like, this is a child actor. It just felt so real the whole time.
Yeah, and a lot of the settings and stuff in India were really like well handled, and all of the stuff with the trains, as we've said, was really good. And I was, as you say, it's a shame actually that they didn't go more into the kind of side stuff of, you know, what is inter-country, interracial adoption like from the perspective of the person adopted. So it's a real, like, development dilemma that people face. And, yeah, so interesting, because each one is a personal story. In Lion, that doesn't really get much attention.
No, but a cool story to be brought to the mainstream. So next up, we're talking about Witless, a BBC Three comedy starring Kerry Howard and Zoe Boyle, which follows two women who are forced to go into witness protection after they witness a murder. And it returned for a second season last week. We did talk about the first season when it aired.
A year ago?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think at least that. So we'll link you back to our previous episode if you want to catch up on
40-something, I think.
On series one. Because actually, this was one of the first things to come out post BBC Three going online only, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was this and 13 and a few others kind of went up on iPlayer as like the BBC Three box sets.
You're dead right. Yeah,
that's how this is served up to you again, so you can watch all 5 episodes of series 2 in one go if you want.
So the last season ended on like quite a big cliffhanger. So it's funny that we're sat here like, when was the last season on? Because you might have to remind yourself of the last 5 minutes of season 1 if you're joining for season 2, wherein they shoot someone through a door.
There's a mole in the police. Your location has been compromised.
They do. So they're hiding out in the flat they've been given as part of the witness protection thing. They've been tipped off that the bad guys are coming to get them.
Their location has been compromised, and as have their identities.
And they are hiding in the bathroom with a gun that they think is the gun like that's part of the crime that they originally witnessed.
The murder weapon, yeah.
Yeah. And they like, someone's jiggling the handle of the bathroom door and like they can see the shadow. So in a panic, Zoe Boyle's character just like shoots through the door, and it turns out that it's their neighbour.
Mm. And their new neighbour who's been a bit suspicious of their identities all along.
Yeah.
So it starts again in media res after this has happened, and they're calling an ambulance and, you know, obviously trying not to become murderers themselves by saving this woman's life. And then it just goes full pelt into action, and it's, this whole season is set over 4 days. So it's really, really like high speed.
It is, you know, there's a really fun like sequence with a caravan on the motorway all kinds of stuff. Like, there's a lot of like physical comedy in this. And I was wondering actually while I was watching this, what makes this a comedy? Because a lot of the things that happen in it are really dark.
Yeah, I said the same stuff. So I had the privilege of interviewing Kerry Howard and Zoe Boyle last week, and the interview is available on newstatesman.com. I was saying to them, you know, this, it does get a lot darker. A lot of the humour of the first season involves the fact that the gang who committed the murders that they've witnessed are basically teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
In this season, you start to see a lot more of the like senior gang people who are all quite scary adults, and really bad things start happening to those teenagers. Lots of violence against these teenagers, and you're like, oh, this is actually really, really horrible. And Kerry Howard said to me that it was a bit like, you need the laughs even more. You need them a lot more in season 2. So when they come, it's like, whew. And there's like a really long, weird scene involving like a teenager having to expose his bollocks like in a gang, and like you don't know which way it's going to go. You think it's going to end horribly, but then it just ends with him like pointing at his balls and being like, this kid's got balls, and it's funny, and you laugh sort of with relief as much as you laugh from it being funny.
Mm.
So I think that's sort of a bit more of the way the humour functions in season 2 than in season 1. I don't know about you.
Yeah, that makes sense, because I did find myself, having watched the first 2 episodes of series 2 like together in a rush, like just sort of outlining the events of them in my mind, I was like, this is not a comedy.
It
doesn't sound like a comedy. If I read this out, my list of what happened out to you, you'd be like, well, that sounds horrible. Is it a thriller that's on Sunday nights?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And yet there are still great lines in this. And I think for me, the best humour just comes from the sort of quite Gavin and Stacey style jokes between the two lead women. So there's a great line where they're in the hospital and they're really hoping that their neighbour gets better after they've shot her. Zoe Boyle's character Rona says, I can't be a murderer. I'm a weekday vegetarian. And it's just like so funny, because there's just a realness to that humour. And Zoe Boyle said to me that when she read that line, she was like, guilty. I actually am a weekday vegetarian. This is really funny.
Yeah, but there's deeper stuff going on with the characters as well, isn't there? Because Zoe Boyle's character, Rona, is meant to be like slightly posher.
Mm.
And from a, you know, either she perceives or she is from like a kind of higher social status.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Kerry Howard's character is supposed to be more like West Country. She's got more of an accent.
She's got a much broader accent, hasn't she?
She's meant to be like basically a bit stupid, I think. Or rather, that's what you're meant to think about her. And then she, you know.
And then she reveals that she's actually much better in a crisis, and she can do things like lie off the cuff, whereas Rona is completely incapable of doing anything in a crisis.
But, you know, and that actually comes out with Jackie, the neighbour, who they shoot through the door.
Mm.
You know, previously, there's a whole plot revolving around the fact that she keeps, like, catcalling Zoe Boyle's character, being like, why are you so stuck up? Why do you think you're better than us?
Mm.
And it has to be Carrie Howard's character who's like, no, don't worry, she's with me. Like, I'm normal, she's normal, we're all right.
Mm.
You know, there's all of that kind of dynamic going on, which is really interesting.
Yeah, it's great fun. I think it just adds a bit of texture to their relationship because it's never like spoken about in the dialogue. It's never like explicitly discussed, but you get a sense of this extra dynamic to their relationship, which is already a little bit strained because Rona doesn't really want to live with Leanne, but Leanne really wants to live with Rona. And Leanne keeps doing weird things to like basically fuck them over because she doesn't want the like the hijinks to end too soon because she's having fun with Rona,
because she thinks that their friendship is going to end once they get to go back to their normal lives, because right at the beginning of series one, Rona has just told her that she's like breaking up with her as a flatmate because she's bought her own place.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that element of Leanne slightly sabotaging their efforts to stay safe because of that as well, which just is an added area of comedy.
Yeah, but I like that it sort of gets more and more absurd every episode, but it also seems to become slightly more real as it becomes more absurd, because that relationship is just strengthening every time you see them, which is, I feels like something I see in a lot of like female fronted comedy at the moment, like Chewing Gum, like Broad City. We've all talked about these shows that are so wacky and weird on the surface. If you, for example, like you say, just try to reel off a list of plot developments, but has something so relatable about it, its core, that you sort of feel like you know these characters. And that's one thing I really like about Willis.
Yeah, because like you were saying, they definitely like settle into the character dynamic to the point where Rona comes to rely on Leanne to do the lying. And there's even one bit, I think, in the first couple of episodes where they find themselves in a strange situation where like an unknowing member of the public is saying, who are you and why are you here? And she just turns to the end, she's like, who are we and why are we here? She's like, come on, do the lying. Do the explaining thing that you do.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's a great comedy, and the episodes are like 20 minutes each. So it's like, it just really breaks up a day, and I really definitely think it's worth checking out.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Totally.
So now we're going to talk about Fen by Daisy Johnson. Last week, Caroline and I read three stories from Daisy Johnson's Fen, though there are more than three in the collection, many more for you to get your teeth into if you fancy it. So we read Starver and Blood Rights, which are the first two stories, and another one called How to Fuck a Man You Don't Know, because I saw the title and was like, yeah, we'll read that. So Caroline, what did you make of these strange stories?
I think they're completely amazing. Mm. You photocopied them out of your book for me so I could read them. And several times I like turned over the last page and I was like, why isn't there more? Like, where's it gone?
Yeah, yeah.
It was really, really good. And there's an eeriness that's in common to all of them, although, you know, they don't follow the same characters or anything, but this idea of the fen runs through all of them as a kind of watery no man's land where the people have certain characteristics and there's a kind of slightly hauntedness of the landscape.
Mm-hmm. They all seem to go into the same pub in every story.
Yeah, they do.
They're called the Fox and Hound, and it has the pregnant barwoman. There are these sort of like little reference points and shadowy figures who reappear story after story.
I think of the three that we read, my favourite was actually the first one, Stava, because it just goes in a direction I was not expecting at all, right? So, you know, spoiler ahead, it is one of those short stories that has a kind of unexpected reveal in it.
Yeah, so if you want to not be spoiled, read it first and then come back and listen to this.
But it appears for the first few pages to be a kind of classic story of like teenage anorexia.
Mm-hmm.
Of it's narrated from the point of view of a girl whose older sister has decided to starve herself, like she just stopped eating.
Yeah, and there are little fragments in it that really reminded me of other anorexia stories. I wrote a piece about the Cassie anorexia plotline in Skins earlier last week. And then there's a paragraph in that this story where Kay, is it? The older sister is telling her younger sister how she pretends to eat food whilst not actually eating food, cutting up all the pieces, holding a fork to her open mouth, but then saying something and putting the fork back down. And it's line for line exactly like that scene of Cassie in Skins, whether that's just because that's a classic trope of anorexia storylines or whether it's because Daisy Johnson was born in 1990 and probably was a teenage girl watching Skins. He felt really like marked by that plotline, like a lot of other people did. I don't know, but yeah, so it really does feel like that typical sister anorexia story.
It really does. But then it just goes in this completely eerie fen direction, because Kay makes herself, as you would expect, she makes herself really ill through not eating for weeks and weeks and weeks, but she starts to transform into something else, you know. She and her sister is complicit in it, that she struggles to breathe unless she can be underwater, and her hands become webbed. And anyway, the end of the story is she's just basically become a fish.
I got the sense, because the story opens with a description of these eels
yeah,
that
she's
were
become an eel.
Yeah, they were basically drained the flooded fens, and then all that was left behind were these eels, and they decided, okay, well, we'll be living off eels for now, but the eels refused to eat, so they had loads of like wasted dead eel that they had to sort of get rid of.
Yeah.
This has obviously been some sort of collective trauma for the people living in the fens, all these dead eels. And then when she sort of starts to become an eel, she's refusing to eat too. It's these weird sort of parallels between human and earth. And
then
very
the,
odd.
The sister does the final act of, you know, she sneaks her sister out down to the river and she lets her go. You know, in this sort of transition of like, this is what you are now and who am I to get in the way of it kind
and
of thing.
And you're like, what?
And then you finish and you're like, what? Her sister became an eel and she just let her go. This is,
I read a short story as a child that I read it from my school library and I've never been able to figure out who wrote it or what it was about. So if seriously listeners know, I remember they helped me out with that Australian program before very, very well, about a woman who gives birth to a fox and then the story is about her, you know, being like, no, it's my baby. And then eventually she comes to terms with the fact that it's not a baby, it's a fox, and she has to let it go.
Mm.
And obviously it's, you know, about parenthood and letting go and so on. But just that image really stuck with me. And this is similar in that it's just like such a visceral, animalistic image that it's quite hard to put down.
I found the same quality in the second story we read, Blood Rites, which is about a kind of coven of women cannibals, essentially. Who, you know, these three women who sort of travel from place to place and they live together and they entice men and then they consume them.
Which I at first thought was some sort of sexual metaphor, and then you realize like, oh no, they're literally eating these men.
They are, yeah. But it has that same sense of inexorable internal logic that while you're reading it you're like, yep, absolutely, then you finish and you're like, what? No. I just rooted for the eating of people.
Yeah, it's really funny. And then the third story is a bit more intangible, and it's a bit less of a clear plot with clear characters, but the quality of her writing is just so good. And I read more than the three that we decided on because I was like, oh, this is such a good read. So I definitely would recommend it.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely outstanding. Definitely going to get the whole book.
Great. So what am I going to be doing next week?
Total change from short stories.
That's how we do it on Seriously.
I thought we might return to mobile games.
Ah.
So we did a game a while ago, Monument Valley, which I think you really liked.
I did. I loved Monument Valley. I wanted more of Monument Valley.
So we're going to have another go at a game. This one's called 80 Days, which is a kind of text-based adventure game, if you remember those from the early days of the internet. But this one has graphical interfaces and stuff as well. But you do a lot of reading of a story. You play the character of Passepartout, who is Jules Verne's valet slash assistant on his 80-day journey. And you make all of the travel arrangements. And you do a lot of like bargaining in markets and packing his luggage and making sure he's got all the right stuff. And yeah, so you buy train tickets and you buy ferry tickets and you plan a route and you try and beat the game and get round in 80 days. But it's one of those things where, you know, it offers you different decisions, different options, and depending on what you choose.
Like a choose your own adventure.
Exactly. So depending on what you choose depends on the journey you take.
Okay. Well, I hope I can fill Passepartout's big shoes. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts. And thanks so much to everyone who left us iTunes reviews this week. Please keep them coming if you can, as it really helps other people find out about the podcast.
Our next event, another Harry Potter quiz, goes on sale on 15th of February at midday. Make sure you're following us on social media so you don't miss out on the chance to buy tickets.
On our website, seriouslypod.com, you can find all our back episodes, plus our specials on Home Alone, Gilmore Girls, Harry Potter, Love Actually, and Friends.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod at all of them.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or just hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.